let's move into this. Alan, it is thrilling to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Kent, it's great to hang out with you and some fellow NAB pastors. At least for the moment, I'm still officially an NAB pastor because my ordination is at home at Sunrise up in Fair Oaks.
So that's where, I think that's where I first met you, isn't that correct?
Yeah, in fact, I still have a memory of you coming to visit, getting ready to plant Oak Hills. I think it was 83 or 4 or something like that.
84, right. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah, I do remember that.
And Alan is married to his wonderful wife, Jem. You have 3 sons. As he said, he's got an NAB background. He lives in Southern California now. Why don't you give us a little overview of what you've been doing the last 20 years or so?
Yeah, well, I live down here in Orange County. We've been in this location for about 18 years, enough time for our oldest to go from kindergarten to 24 and in college. As far as life and work, I this whole idea of spiritual formation was kind of a theoretical for me in the early and late 80s. I was reading Dallas's books and Richard Foster's books and giving very thoughtful sermons about all these things that I didn't practice. And it was in around about 90 that I hit kind of a crisis of ministry, and I'm in my late 20s. It's really bad pacing. God brought some mentors along who were living some of these things and had been for decades, really. And that was my introduction to spiritual formation as a lived way of life and a lived way of leadership. And that was 90, so 26 years ago. And that really put me on a new path in terms of what it looked like for me to walk with Jesus and what it looked like at first to be a pastor in a local church environment, mostly with youth or college students. And then later, from about 2000 on, in a more itinerant role, training, teaching, encouraging, mentoring, providing spiritual direction, things like that, with mostly church leaders. And then more recently, that's expanded to mission leaders, parachurch leaders, business leaders for that matter, really trying to get at this idea of what does it look like to engage our work, our leadership with Jesus. Where there have been times in the past where it felt more like an activity I did for him, and I wasn't sure how close he was while I was doing it.
Thanks for that much. I know recently you've gotten involved in kind of a different direction, but a new adventure. Could you just touch on that and the details of it? We'll send via email to everybody on this call, but just kind of tell us a bit about it now and what you're up to.
Sure. Well, this group of friends, mentors, almost spiritual fathers, they were part of an organization, and I was associated with them I still am as friends, but joined the staff back in 97 when I stepped away from my last local church pastoral role. And I was a part of that group, you know, up until the beginning of this year. And what I found what I discovered was that this book I wrote, An Unhurried Life, was getting more attention and welcome than I had expected it to. And it was beginning to open some new kinds of doors for opportunities for encouraging a wider circle of leaders, not just domestically, but in a lot of different places in the world. And so I kind of hit a point where I had to decide whether I was going to start saying no to doors that the book was opening, or I was going to say yes to them. And if I said yes to them, I really needed to step away from my executive director role with this other nonprofit and step into the development of a new nonprofit, something I'd never done. And so, we launched the corporation in the spring. We filed our papers, and we just got 2 weeks ago a yes from the IRS that we are now a nonprofit, the focus of which is to train and to develop further resources to do further writing in the spirit of this unhurried life theme. So, for example, the I've just finished second edits on the next book, which will be titled An Unhurried Leader, also with InterVarsity. It's scheduled for June release. And then we're developing, you know, resources, online resources, downloadable resources, some online coursework, more and more, that we hope will help resource, train, encourage fellow leaders in following Jesus' unhurried way of life and leadership. So that's a little bit about what I've been up to really this year, since the beginning of the year.
Well, great. And I think we'll send out we'll send out some of the information to everyone. There's this whole online course you have that people could look into. You get a discount code for NAB, and they'll be able to benefit from that. And you can talk about more on that if you so desire. But let me turn to the book for a second. Let me just ask a simple question. Why did you write the book? What drove you? And so why did you write it?
Sure. Well, you know, there's always more than one answer to a question like that. I mean, at one level, it's a chance to reflect on a journey I'd been on for some time. But the more immediate triggers or seeds, I guess, really gave birth to the book were a few things. One, it was a line that Dallas Willard had spoken to John Ortberg, and that he, you know, shared in, you know, The Life You've Always Wanted. And it was that line that Dallas said, you need to ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And that was a rather convicting sentence for me, and an uncomfortable one, too. I kind of see myself as a recovering workaholic, perfectionist, a recovering hurrier. And so I felt I needed to wrestle with that piece of spiritual direction. And the other was actually something else that Dallas said to another friend of mine. It was a conversation, and Dallas was saying, you know, that he was asking a small group, if you had just one word to describe Jesus, what word would you use? And, you know, so people in the room threw out titles like Lord and Savior, and character qualities like compassionate and gentle and humble and loving, and you know, the list went on. And then Dallas said, well, I think if I had one word, the word I'd prefer is relaxed. Just remember the first time I heard that, that really tweaked me. And I wasn't even sure that was good. I sort of pictured Jesus in a lazy boy, you know, watching TV for hours on end or something. And I just couldn't see relaxed as a positive leadership quality, let alone something about Jesus that would be worth highlighting. And so it was coming out of that I set aside 3 days of retreat, and I just went to a local monastery, and the only thing I did other than sleep and eat was read the Gospels over and over and over with kind of that question, is Jesus relaxed? Is that a good thing? And in my own thinking, it began to translate into Jesus being unhurried, which was another word that, of course, Dallas had used and others had used to describe the spiritual life and its healthiest expressions. And I just came to the conclusion that it was an absolute genius description of Jesus, that he was, you know, he was unhurried enough to see temptation coming and to say a simple no. He was unhurried enough to cultivate this rich, deep friendship with the Father throughout his years of ministry, no matter how busy things got with the crowds. You know, he was unhurried enough to stop when everybody on his team wanted to keep going to get to the agenda item that they'd started the day planning for. You know, he was unhurried enough to pour himself profoundly into this group of 12 and then the bigger circle around that, and really invest an immense amount of time that, in at least in his earthly years, did not immediately seem to have borne the, you know, most dramatic looking fruit. And all of that I saw as just a, you know, just a few illustrations of Jesus' unhurried but incredibly fruitful way of both living and engaging in the kingdom work the Father gave him.
Cool. Again, want to remind everyone that if you want to ask a question of Alan or a follow-up question of anything, you can contact Lisa at lschmidt@nabconf.org, and she will pass that those questions along to me, and we'll deal with them as we have time. Alan, agree with, I mean, I think we could probably pull 100 or so pastors, and if we asked them to give us a word that described Jesus, that relaxed probably wouldn't have been one of them. And I think it's just marvelous to think about. Do you think, how would I ask this? What would you think is the relaxed quotient on Christian leaders today on a scale of, you know, 1 to 50 or something? Are we relaxed or are we not?
Yeah, that's I'm trying to put a number on that. It's tricky. I can just speak, you know, thinking out loud. In the last year, and I've not only had a chance to be with leaders kind of here in the States around the country, but had a chance in April to be with leaders in India, leaders in Africa in August, and then a couple of weeks ago, leaders in St. Petersburg, Russia. So that was beginning of the year in the Dominican Republic. So a Latin setting, African setting, an Asian setting, and a European setting. And what I find is a lot of leaders who are tired, or if they're not tired, they're anxious, or if they're not anxious, they're overwhelmed. And there's so much that feels like, you know, they're not getting as much done as they'd like to have gotten done. They feel busy, but not fruitful. So if I had to take a 0 to 50, there seem to be a lot of leaders who would give themselves a sub 25 and maybe even a little lower than that. And then the ones who seem relaxed, the fear you have is that, well, they're not doing very much, you know, relaxed comes easy to them. They're just sitting around, you know, doing hardly anything. So that's one of the challenges of the word unhurried. Almost everywhere I go, the thing that's really challenging is that some leaders only hear that I'm talking about their calendar and their appointment book and their to-do list, and that I'm somehow telling them do fewer things and make fewer appointments and do less work. And that's exactly not what I'm trying to communicate. You know, busy and hurried are not the same thing. Busy, that's just a matter of calendar. Hurried, that's a matter of soul. And that's where I'm trying to speak. I'm trying to talk about our hurried souls that we keep, many of us anyway, say, you know, that we don't have time for this, that, or the other. But this, that, and the other, the sorts of things we say we don't have time for are often things that matter deeply to us and I think to Jesus, and we frantically think that a lot of the things we're doing in a strange way seems to be getting in the way of kinds of invitations maybe that Jesus is extending to us as persons as well as pastors.
Well, expand that a little bit. What does an unhurried soul look like if it's not just I got too many things to do and not enough hours in the day? How could, for example, a person whose schedule is not out of control, so to speak, but they're still living with a hurried soul, what does that look like?
Well, I think a few things. One, I think it looks like the difference between, you know, anxiety and peace. I think of my own leadership and how many times, if I were really honest with myself, how often anxiety was the engine driving things I did. Yeah. Wanting people to be happy with stuff I was up to. Whereas I think an unhurried soul would be that, I think it was Dallas who said, you know, anything you can do in anxiety would be far better done in peace. And a lot of times I didn't believe that. I really thought my anxiety was an asset. It's taken a while to come to believe differently about my anxiety, that the drivenness it produces in me, that kind of inner hurry, actually doesn't bear very good fruit. I may get a lot of stuff done, but that's not the same as how I live and how I relate to people and how I do my work when I'm at peace. I think another is that hurry that I get so busy with tasks, I don't have time for people. That's a real weakness of mine in the past. And so my hurry has me getting a lot of important things done, church ministry and otherwise, and has me semi-present at best with the people right in front of me. And so it's that sort of somebody's looking at me, but I'm kind of looking about 5 degrees past them because I'm getting ready for the next thing that's on my calendar or the thing I had planned to do, and I hadn't planned to be talking to this person right now. I think an unhurried soul realized that, you know, whatever Jesus means by fruit that lasts, it's really going to involve people. There are a lot of the tasks I'm up to. They may not matter to even to me much 5 years from now, let alone 10, 20, 100 years from now. But things I do to serve people, hear people, love people, bless people, whatever, that's going to last somehow. But when I'm in a hurry, I run past people. I think another, maybe one more way would be just, a lot of my work is mentoring and kind of the spiritual direction function. And I just meet a lot of leaders who are too hurried to care for their own souls and make space like Jesus does to, for example, to withdraw to lonely places to pray. It feels like a luxury they can't afford, that we can't afford. So that might be three expressions of what I think an unhurried soul might look like.
So thanks for that. You have this ministry. I mean, it's called unhurriedliving.com. Probably nobody on this phone call pastors a church called Unhurried Living Baptist Church of wherever. Because we have, Sunday schools get staffed and someone's got to negotiate the new copy machine lease and all those things that need to get done. What are some of the ways of understanding our calling, how we spend our hours, that addresses the issue that things have to get done, but maybe not all of them have to get done, but how do we do the job and still pursue a heart or a soul that is growing increasingly unhurried so that we become relaxed like Jesus is?
Yeah, that's a critical question, and it's a very practical one that that I wrestle with. This year has been me trying to start a new nonprofit. I had no idea how much work that was going to be and how many dang pieces that was going to involve and how many totally unexpected delays and, are you funding terrorism? I didn't expect anyone to ask me that question. I was never in my heart to go out and, develop some terror rings. But so, all of the details of just this startup have tested whether I can live what I'm talking about in my real life and with then the financial realities of a new startup. I think there are a few things. One is it helps me to remember that my identity is not in the stuff I'm getting done. And that may seem detached from the question you ask, but for me, when my identity is wrapped up in how much I'm getting done and whether people like what I'm getting done and whether my accomplishments, whether I'm keeping all the plates spinning, the problem is that's never a very satisfying identity. It's not very substantial. Whereas even in the midst of the same busy schedule, if I'm walking through it with a deep and abiding sense that I'm already treasured, I'm already a friend of Jesus. I already have a sense of value and meaning and purpose. And I bring that to this long list of tasks that this day holds for me or the appointments. When I'm not going to my work to try and get something from the cup of my life, to try and fill my life with good words from people or a sense of accomplishment or some sort of acquiring, this, that, or the other, I'm a lot more relaxed. I'm a lot more confident. I'm a lot more buoyant. I have a lot less resentment when the to-do list seems to be taking from me instead of giving anything to me. And so in my own full schedule, I find that, for example, the sense that God is saying to me the moment I wake up, you know what, Alan, you really are my beloved son. I'm very pleased with you. That pleasure is not rooted in accomplishment or acquisition or the good opinion of more and more people. It really is simply rooted in his perspective on me. That frees me. And then I'm able to navigate a boatload of practical details. And boy, church ministry, I don't know if those ever end. It's just endless. And I don't know if it's ever been harder to be a pastor than it perhaps is today. It's been a little while since I held a pastoral role in a local church, but I have a lot of friends still who, for whom that is their vocational path. And it's, I think it's a whole lot harder now than when I was on a staff back in the late 90s.
So do you think, just playing out that a little bit further, do you think it's possible, or, well, maybe that's not the right question. Do you think, how would one go about maybe perhaps changing a culture in a church or a ministry where the idea of being relaxed becomes more important than getting things done? And again, relax not in terms of, you know, not having a, not just around our calendar, but the state of our soul. Do you think that's possible in a church, in a business that is, you know, it's got to make enough money to pay the employees, et cetera?
Yeah.
How do you create that kind of culture?
Yeah, I think a few ways, at least that I've seen it happen and seen it work. I think probably at the center of it is a fresh vision of Jesus. I think if what we're talking about here has merit, I think it does. But I think that if it does, it has to be a facet of our discipleship. That the reason I'm choosing a more unhurried way is because I've seen that Jesus lived a more unhurried way, and I'm trying to follow him. And it's that vision that begins to transform how I assess things. And it begins to transform my confidence level that something that seems slow to, let's say, businessmen on boards that I'm accountable to, I can give an apologetic for it in the spirit of Jesus. I can say, we may not be as frantically busy as you would like us to be, but let me talk about the strategy here of why we're doing some of the things we're doing, why we're creating a rhythm. I mean, for example, the rhythm of Jesus, who often withdraws to lonely places to pray. I'm confident. I'm being silly, but I'm confident that verse was not in my Bible for the first 10 years of my Christian life. I mean, I never heard anybody quote that verse. And I read through the Bible, you know, plenty of times. That was our thing. Read through the Bible in a year. So every year, somehow, I had blinders to the fact that that existed. Jesus often withdrew to lonely places to pray. Often just blows my mind. And if I were honest, there were a lot of seasons where I would have to say, well, I don't know, I never would have been the word I would have used. And then other times, occasionally, sometimes, but in my own humble opinion is that those were the moments that gave Jesus vision and gave Jesus courage and gave Jesus confidence and gave Jesus direction for the kingdom work he would then do next. In fact, if you study Luke, you can see that in every moment where Jesus withdraws, I think there's seven of them, in every moment that Jesus withdraws, then in the next moment of the gospel, there's some new expression of ministry that emerges, whether it's a movement from just his local work there in Nazareth and surrounding villages to then stepping into a more itinerant regional role. In each case, there's a tangible ministry thing that happens. And so this unhurried way is not detached from the realities of ministry productivity and fruit and practicalities like paying bills and all that. I would argue it's the engine of it. It's the following of Jesus' way that actually produces the kind of, hey, if you seek God's kingdom first and his righteousness, actually, it's actually true that all these things will be added to you. But I've spent a lot of time in my pastoral work seeking all these things. And man, they become overwhelming. And then I sort of assume to seek him first. And that just doesn't work so hot for me. So part of it is my own modeling, my own growing courage and confidence that this is a discipleship to Jesus question. And then gathering, one of the other things that's always been helpful, especially when I was in a local church role, pastoral role, was finding people who wanted to walk this way alongside me. Sometimes they were positional leaders like elders or staff members. Sometimes, though, they were simply hungry people, didn't have any official positional authority, but they were hungry. And as we sort of live this way together, even as I continue to carry responsibilities that I had and kept tending what needed tending, this growing community of people began to demonstrate a way of life that was tantalizing to other folks who wouldn't have thought that was all that inviting. And that's been a helpful path at times.
Good, good. Here's a question that came in. It's, I think in some ways you've addressed it in the issue of identity, but let me just ask it the way it came in. First, an expression of appreciation for distinguishing between busy and hurried, but how does a pastor live out of his or her calling in an unhurried manner without giving in to the pushy, urgent Messiah complex that we all too readily experience? How do we resist or flee this temptation? So here's a temptation that's an internal one. We may want to blame the external demands of having to get things done, but there's some internal voices that are screaming at us. So how would you have kind of fleshed that out a little bit more?
So for me, I would have to describe myself as something of a recovering people pleaser, and that has some roots in my own growing up years, trying to make sure dad was happy, mom was happy, and some of the dynamics of my family. And I brought that into my adult life, and I brought that into pastoral ministry, and I continue to wrestle with it in my current ministry. What's been absolutely critical to my recovery is realizing I do not desperately need people to like the things I'm doing. I also don't need to run around purposely making people unhappy, and messing with them. But for me, for example, in that dynamic, I began to realize it's really hard to lead people you desperately need something from. And so for me, I really needed to come to those places of realizing there's only one Messiah. I am not him. And that is great news. That is such good news, because that is a yoke that's too heavy for any one of us to bear. But when I realized that as a pastor, I'm a pointer of the way to the great shepherd, that's not just a spiritual, kind of saying, but that's a functional reality, that somehow in my shepherding of people, I'm trying to help them see Jesus and walk with Jesus and follow Jesus. Now, again, that can end up sounding like Sunday school language, but I have also, unfortunately, been the guy wanting people to like what I do and follow me without the additional Pauline, as I follow Christ added on. So for me, what has relaxed the coils of that kind of Messiah complex on my heart and on my way of doing things has been to realize that this thing doesn't actually land on me first. It lands on Jesus' shoulders, that he's invited me. What an honor it is to be invited to join him in the shepherding of a particular community, or now in my case, some group of leaders. That has freed me from the desperate need to succeed, to prove something about myself, or to succeed to make sure everybody around me is happy with me. Now, I'm still in recovery, and I still find that to be a dynamic whose root has not died in me. But that's been part of how I've navigated some of those dynamics.
You said something that could, one of those things that someone says in a meeting and someone gets up and writes it on the whiteboard because you want to think about it for a while. You said it's very hard to lead people you need something from. So could you flesh that out? What, you know, how it relates into the, what do you, what's your definition there of need? How do we live with mutuality with each other?
Sure, sure.
This kind of detachment and all that. It's a beautiful phrase that I'm going to pretend that I made up in future conversations.
Yeah,
with people.
Absolutely.
Tease that out a bit.
Yeah, so the phrase I used was, it's very hard to lead people you desperately need something from. And I think that desperately is key.
Okay.
Because otherwise, yeah, you know, I don't mean to appeal to sort of a fairly classic North American independent Lone Ranger-like leadership model. I do believe in teams, and I do believe in us ministry and not just me ministry. But I'm talking more about that sense that I'm looking to people for something really when it's all said and done, I can only receive from God. Now, it may come through people, but my eyes are on God as I receive it. My eyes aren't on these people. So, for example, if you can kind of imagine, I use this as a visual. It's hard to do visuals on phone calls, but I'll try and kind of paint a picture. Like right now here in my office, I'm holding this little mug. It looks like a camp mug, kind of one of those blue steel looking coffee mugs that you might sit and drink coffee around the campfire out of. And so, you know, I'm holding it here. And it could easily double as, you know, like a panhandler's cup at the corner wanting some change when you stop at that uncomfortable moment where he walks up past your car. What I find is that, you know, this idea of a cup, Psalm 23 has got a cup. Something really cool is happening with it. It's running over. It's got more than it can hold. My cup runs over. Well, so this picture of, you know, it's hard to lead people you desperately need something from is sometimes I've found that in ministry, I'm going into ministry environments, a preaching environment, a board environment, a staff meeting environment, or whatever. And really, if I were honest, my cup's empty or mostly empty. And when my cup's empty or mostly empty in those environments, it's very hard not to be looking for something in those environments that'll fill my cup. So when I was in a college ministry role, twice a week I was teaching, Sunday mornings and sometime in the midweek. And man, at the end of the message, I'll tell you what, I wanted people coming up saying, "Hey, wow, great message, Pastor Allen." And that's kind of picture, you know, picture me with my mug out there for them to throw their three pennies into, you know. And I'm standing at the door with my mug waiting for them to put something in my cup. Well, you know, honestly, I didn't give too many hard words in the way I taught. Not that that's got to be the main thing you do, but sometimes hard words need to be said. Because I'll tell you what, at the end of one of those messages, nobody's coming up putting coins in your cup for that one. Very hard to lead people you desperately need something from. And so, you know, when I'm having a counseling conversation, I realize, you know what, if I'm going to serve this person well, I'm going to have to say something, and they're really not going to like it. Well, my people-pleasing self doesn't want to say it because I don't want them to not like me, and I don't want them to stop putting things in my cup, you know, like thanks for this great counseling session or whatever. So that's maybe a visual of it. It's like I could actually, and I found this to be actually true, not just theoretically, I could actually go into ministry environments, so speaking, teaching, mentoring, strategic planning, you know, to-do list doing, whatever, day full of appointments. I could go into any one of those places, and I could go into those places with a soul that's full. That's another expression of this idea of unhurried. I'm unhurried enough to do what I do from a full soul instead of feeling like I'm giving my last few drops most of the time. And I've been in seasons where it felt like the latter. So maybe that gets underneath some of that.
Yeah, that's great. Let's play a little bit. Let's go back to the thing you just kind of touched on earlier in the call about some people perhaps hearing the word unhurried, and it gives them an excuse for what could perhaps be called laziness, or perhaps tease this out a little bit more, the whole kind of ancient sin of acedia, that kind of slothfulness, or what is the difference between living with an unhurried soul and kind of a slothfulness or an apathy or acedia that we begin to live with? Kind of give us a historical view, and to some degree, what's the process of addressing that?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the chapters in the book talks about unhurried isn't lazy. And that's one of the things that sometimes when I'm talking to high-level busy leaders, that's what they think I'm recommending. And actually, I mean, a few things. One, there are different kinds of laziness. Unfortunately, I have bumped into some leaders in different environments who really have become kind of lazy and disengaged, and they're not really trying very hard anymore. Honestly, most of the pastors I run into, that's not where they find themselves. I tend to find pastors on the other end of that spectrum. But in terms of this, you know, what began as the eight deadly thoughts and then later was refined into the seven deadly sins, one of which, the seven deadly sins version, was turned into sloth, which kind of sounds like classic Proverbs like laziness. But the idea was a little bit more subtle than that. It was more of a soul dynamic than it was an activity or lack of activity dynamic. You know, in a sense, acedia, I kind of see acedia as that halfway point weariness, a kind of soul weariness. It's, you know, it's exciting to start a race. It's exciting to finish a race. Running, you know, mile 12, 13, 14 of a marathon, probably not the most exciting, let alone 20, 21 and such. And so it's that point where, you know, I started something and now I'm in the middle of it. It's not nearly as exciting as it once was. I think maybe another way to think about unhurried versus lazy is that unhurried is very awake. It's very alert. It's very attentive. Lazy, slothful, acedia, that's more of a sleepiness. There's a weariness that, you know, then biblical invitations to don't grow weary are really an invitation to resist those temptations to the kind of weariness that comes when you've been at something for a while and you've lost the vision of what it is you're doing, and maybe lost a sense of I'm doing this with God. I'm not just doing this for God, you know, especially a God who's at some distance from my realities. So, you know, I think, you know, I'm 55. Acedia is far more of a temptation for me here and now than it was 15, 20 years ago. Being able to stay awake to the reality of God with me, to stay awake to the freshness of the kingdom at all moments. Those are some of the temptations I find I have to wrestle with that I never had to wrestle with in my 20s, 30s, young 40s.
So acedia, at some level, you're saying is not at some level, you're coming out and saying it. It's more of a temptation the longer you are in ministry, perhaps even just the older you get.
Yeah, I think it's one of the temptations that really comes into focus or becomes a dynamic when you've been at something a while. You know, if you're in ministry for 2 years, acedia is probably not near the top of the list. Pride might be, you know, and some others. But if you've been in ministry a while or you've been living a while, I think that's when, you know, acedia is called the noonday demon. It's the halfway point there through the day.
Yeah.
It's not the end of the day, like, hooray, we made it. Let's enjoy our night of sleep. It's not the morning. Wow, here's a fresh new day. Hooray. Can't wait for these for the next few things I'm going to do. It's that halfway middle of the day point. I think midlife crisis, there's a lot of reasons for it, but I think sometimes it's kind of an acedia thing. You know, for example, on that whole identity question, I think sometimes acedia is realizing it's that point where all the stuff I've poured my energy into and all, you know, the basket I've put my eggs in is not giving me the returns I thought it was gonna. I thought climbing this ladder would give me a great sense of satisfaction, and I'm a pretty high rung, and I'm not nearly as satisfied as I thought I would. And making people happy, which I thought was my strategy, not making me happy, and it's not helping me much. I think sometimes, you know, the flat side of that is an acedia-like disengagement and despair, and I quit, I give up, even if it's only internal. I think the opportunity in those moments is the opportunity of rediscovery and maybe realizing things you were attached to, things you were abiding in, like false vines trying to suck life out of them. There wasn't any life in them anyway. And maybe this is an opportunity to decide maybe Jesus is the true vine in some fresh way that I'd never quite considered before. Maybe that really is the place of life for me. And maybe that would help wake me up from places where I'm tempted to sleepiness, a weariness, or discouragement.
Alan, let's dig into that a little bit, or just burrow down a bit. Let's say a person, pastor, Christian leader, is perhaps you hear the description of the CDR, and you're thinking of your own life, and you're saying, okay, I spent a lot of nights getting home, and I just veg out in front of, I binge watch some Netflix series, and I escape into, you know, thinking if the Cubs will make the World Series again, and we begin to perhaps a numbing of ourselves so that I don't have to face, you know, what I'm afraid of, or even face my lethargy or my acedia. If that begins to become, we become aware of that, practically in the details of my life today, what do I have to do, walk into, what do I have to face, and what will it be like? What could I expect as I begin walking down that road? Because it can't be something where I, you know, snap out of it, stop doing it. I would imagine the road to health is going to be uncomfortable. It may feel like you're going backwards. There may be some emptiness in that. So could you tease that out a bit?
Yeah. I mean, so when I think of seasons where that kind of there's a phrase from Tilden Edwards' book, Sabbath Time. He uses the phrase mind-numbing escape. Uh-huh. And it's a great phrase. I think, one, you have to realize, wake up to, the fact that numbing and refreshment, anesthesia and refreshment, are very, very different dynamics. What I need is refreshment somehow. Jesus invites me to rest just as much as to work. But what will rest look like? You know, when I've sat and watched, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours of TV, I cannot say I stand up rested. I usually stand up mildly depressed and a little headachy and empty, feeling empty. And so I know for me, one of the things that's been important is I'm going to have a trusted friend that I can just come clean with that about. And I find that very shameful, because I'm a performance-oriented guy, and I just cannot imagine I am sitting around wasting as much time as I'm wasting doing that kind of crap. It's just ridiculous. But I'm ashamed and embarrassed, and so my temptation is to just see if I can figure it out myself. And that almost never works. And so just to have a trusted friend, I can say, look, here's the story. Here's what's happening. I am apparently so freaked out or anxious or fearful or weary or whatever that I'm spending this kind of time just vegging out in front of TVs. Now, the good news is that most people be able to empathize and hear you and not play judge. But, you know, you want to choose someone you trust and who will listen well, because I'm going to need help. Acedia is one of those things, kind of like self-deception and a few others, that's very hard to find your way out of alone. I think a lot of addictive things are very hard to find your way out of alone. And acedia has a way of having some of those dynamics. So that's one. Another one, which may sound a little bit ironic, but I think choosing to have times of purposeful solitude that are not an engagement in amusement or media or other kinds of mind-numbing activity. Now, that is, there's a certain counterintuitiveness to it, but I think that there's two answers in terms of the activity arena that are classically given for acedia. One of them is just be involved in practical, tangible, fruitful labor. The monks, it would be go out and do your job, care for the chickens, take care of the bees, you know, do your daily job, do it well, do it with excellence. Don't flake out on it. But the other element in a monastic setting, for that matter, in my experience in a pastoral setting, is deciding what you're going to do about solitude, true solitude, not just loneliness, not just alone, but alone with God. And often that has been a place where I awaken to, for example, the dynamics of acedia and why it is that I'm wasting time, and then my guilt about that and how that's just creating a cycle that's only driving it deeper. Whereas realizing I have a God who is very interested in me and would enjoy my company if I wanted to just hang out with him alone or with him in community with others. But I think often in seasons of acedia, true solitude gets squeezed out and replaced with this kind of mind-numbing activity, and it's kind of a catch-22. So those are at least, you know, finding a trusted friend to tell my story with, even though I may be embarrassed and ashamed of my lack of productivity and my escapism, whatever form it takes, whether it's a milder, innocent, like, you know, sports or sitcoms or whatever, or whether it's taken a bit of a darker turn, internet porn, right, you know, whatever. Right. Having a friend that I can come clean with and be, trust. If I'm really intend to find my way out of this, if I'd really like to find my way to a yoke that fits well and is easy, I think those are some of the things that'll be important steps to take.
Alan, thanks. This is brilliant stuff, really. Are we afraid of, is there fear here somehow? Is there, do we have something messed up in our mind about the life that God is calling us to that would, I mean, we get some benefit from whatever, what do you call it, mind-numbing?
Mind-numbing escape, yeah.
Mind-numbing escape. There's something about that that works for us. It's an escape that numbs our mind, and so we don't have to feel. Are we afraid? What are we afraid of that keeps us from that honest conversation with someone else? Do we fear failure? Do we fear rejection? What's the dynamic that keeps us away from life, actually?
Well, I think you listed a couple of really good candidates. Failure, I don't like the idea of that. I sure don't want to admit to anyone I hope looks up to me, or I hope admires me, or I hope, you know, thinks highly of me, that, you know, sometimes I wrestle with this kind of a pattern or rhythm. I think, you know, if you think about it just at a real practical level, why am I numbing? Well, because I feel something unpleasant, or, you know, it goes up from there. I feel something painful, and I don't want to feel it anymore. And so I'd like to stop feeling it. And this is a very effective strategy for a short window of time, not to have to wrestle with those thoughts and feelings. And instead, I can just, you know, push pause on all that. Well, I'm not saying that's always bad forever and ever. Amen. But the pain might actually be trying to say something. And I could find, instead of numbing myself from anxiety, I might find my way to a place of discovering peace, where then my numbing strategy wouldn't be as necessary as it was. I could watch a game or a, you know, show I like or whatever, and I could do it just because I like doing it. I don't need it to numb me. I can just enjoy it. I could actually be present to it, just like I could be present to other stuff. So I think that's one is, you know, what is it I'm not wanting to feel? And how might Jesus want to meet me there? He's really good at that. He's very good at healing. He's very good at restoring. He could help me come to a place of seeing why my anxiety, what it is, and why it is I could very easily decide to let go of it as a life strategy or as an orientation. You know, for me, anxiety, I've told this story before. My mom knows I tell it. You know, my mom grew up in an orphanage, 4 to 14, Midwest. In an orphanage, you learn anxiety. You just flat do. You actually don't have enough of things you need often. And so that 14-year-old girl eventually got married and had a first son. That was me. And I got a master's course in anxiety growing up. And, you know, again, my mom and I have talked about it. I'm not blaming her for me, but that's a dynamic now that goes way down into my cells that I'm having to constantly decide, am I going to, when I feel high anxiety, because I'm in a year where the finances are a little tighter than usual because I'm starting a new nonprofit, or 2 weeks ago when I'm getting on a bus in St. Petersburg, Russia, and then I reach back and my wallet's gone, and I realize I've been pickpocketed. Well, anxiety just washes over me. I mean, uninvited, but man, there it is. 10 on a Richter scale, you know, anxiety. Well, I could take the strategy of numbing, or I could say, even here and now, it's actually true. Jesus is actually still right. Anxiety here and now in this particular season or in that particular experience, it's not doing me one bit of good. It is not improving my situation even in the slightest. It will provide me no strategies to make my way forward fruitfully, to address the practical issues in this case, in one case of replacing a whole wallet and its contents, or in the other case, raising funding that I need to continue this thing I started at the beginning of the year. I could actually decide that, you know, instead of numbing this anxiety, I could find my way to following Jesus to places of substantial peace that would actually, now to use Paul language, would actually guard my heart and my mind. So in terms of what is it that, you know, keeps us numbing, I think, yeah, maybe it's a trusting that there is a way to wholeness or rest or refreshment, and that maybe the only strategy I'm used to using is this numbing one. But I think Jesus' invitation is really an invitation to communion and to wholeness and to healing. And that's a good invite for us as pastors. Our following that invite would be wonderful for our congregations.
That's beautiful stuff. This is I know it's going to sound like a rhetorical question, but I actually, it feels this is what's coming up in me as you're talking. So is God good? Is this life he's inviting us to not pursue the mind-numbing escapes? If I don't do that and all I have is the life that he's offering, is that good? Is that a good life?
Isn't that a great question? You know, I just think in ministry, the most beautiful resource I have is my own life coming to more fully trust that what you just said is actually true. That I have been invited to a life that is beyond imagining. It's not to say that it doesn't bring its challenges. I mean, with my travel, you know, being in Africa, I was actually in Nigeria, and here are brothers and sisters, any one of whom could raise their hand and said, yes, I've had someone killed because they follow Jesus. So the following Jesus thing isn't always easy, and it can be painful, but it is good. It is so good. And coming to trust that and coming to experience that, experiencing that in, you know, personal solitary encounters with God, experiencing that in the wonder of a community of people seeking together, experiencing that in the engagement of proclaiming good news, you know, but trying to let myself live good news, feel good news, trust good news, that my life is a place where God would like good news to feel at home. And then I could speak from a place like that, and I could relate from a place like that, and I could do the work of ministry from a place like that. And the measure of the impact of that on little chance passing conversations, which are nowhere on my to-do list, might become some of the most fruitful stuff I do. And I'd still get the things done, or may decide some of the things that were on my list didn't matter all that much. And if they didn't get done, nobody died, and I don't actually care much. And God's probably not, you know, fretting with Father as Father, Son, and Spirit about the fact that to-do list didn't get done. you know, this good and beautiful God, I just find that for me, seeking to follow Jesus' unhurried rhythm in a number of different ways has helped me grow confident in how good he is and how good the kingdom really is, that there really is, that what we have to offer is really such good news. And it helps so much when we feel it and trust it and are finding our ways, our own ways, into living it. And, you know, I think settling for some of those mind-numbing strategies, I think we're just giving up on so much of what Jesus would like to do. Now, it might involve us stepping through a door of fear or a door of anxiety or a door of uncomfortable honesty, or I don't know. But every time I've stepped through a door like that, I have found my way into a place where I saw the kingdom in a fresh way that I sure needed. And I've been able to recommend it more confidently after that.
Wow. Alan, here's a tender question from a beautiful man. He says, how do you find refreshment when you have been serving in a long-term church ministry, feeling that you have tried to be faithful but seeing little effect? What is the Lord looking for, and how can I know if I have pleased him?
Yeah, boy, I have great respect for that question and what, you know, might be under it. I'm thinking of a guy. He's a pastor of a small church. I met him now, gosh, 15 years ago. Small church. This particular church was an ethnically focused church. It was a church where the pastor was sort of expected to be everywhere at all times, not just church stuff, but social stuff and birthday parties. And if they had bar mitzvahs, he'd have to be at those too. And, you know. I remember when he came to a community process that I was a part of, we had some conversations. I could see in his face he was tired. He was a little discouraged. He wasn't sure if he was making much of a difference doing what he did. And his language to me was, I think I'm just going to go back and teach. And this guy had like a PhD from a prestigious British school. I mean, he was sharp guy. I mean, he could teach almost anywhere. But he had felt called to serve this church. He'd been there really quite a long time. But at the end of that retreat, he said, I really think I'll probably retire and just go back to teach. Well, as we talked about, okay, how might you make some space in your schedule, as full as it is, to tend your soul, to be able to hear the voice of the Father saying in the midst of your faithful long-term ministry, I'm so pleased with you. You're my very dear son, and I'm really happy with you right now doing what you do. And so at the end of that particular retreat, and we would come back together and reconnect about 3 or 4 months later, he decided he was going to take his Thursday mornings. And, you know, his busyness meant he never had time for sermon prep. His busyness meant he had very little time for refreshing prayer. You know, he was trying to wrestle with intercessory prayer because he felt like as a pastor, he had to do that for people. But the kind of prayer that just enjoyed tending the relationship, that was non-existent for him. So Thursday morning, he was going to get to the office early. He was going to tell his secretary, his board, and key leaders, I'm going to ask you to let me take Thursday morning until lunch to just meet with God. I'm going to be praying for you. I'm going to be enjoying the scriptures in part about what I might speak on the next weekend. I'm going to just be meeting with God. I really feel the need for that. If an emergency arises, here's who you can talk to. They know how to get me if there's an emergency that requires my presence, but I'm going to ask you to let me do this. And, you know, kind of on, because they trusted him, he'd been there a long time, they said, okay. 4 months later, he came back and he said, well, here's what happened. One, they all said, your sermons are better. You know, it's funny when you have time to prepare them, how much better they are. But it was more than just sermon prep. It was, there was something about his soul that was happening. There was a sense of in this long-term small church, faithful ministry, he was hearing the voice of the Father in a fresh way, affirming him. And then from that place of affirmation, he was able to faithfully engage with the people God entrusted it to him. That what was interesting was his congregation said, we think maybe you need a couple of those mornings a week, because they'd seen some changes in just his demeanor and his freshness, his encouragement level, his joy, his peace. So between the second and third retreat of this community we were part of together, he established that. Well, what happened was he began to have an experienced confidence of his value in the eyes of the Father that was in no way connected to performance, but in fact was an engine for really fruitful work, a new level of encouragement, a new level of engagement with people, a sense of inviting them in fresh ways to the following of Jesus that he'd faithfully been engaged in for decades at that point. The story continues here. About 2 years ago, he retired. He ended up leaving that church, but it was many years later, went to another church and finished his ministry years there, all in pastoral ministry. This guy is as fresh now in his later 60s as any 20 or 30 something. So I'm not talking about anything magical, but I'm saying that there is this rhythm that one way or another, I think Jesus is inviting us into, especially when we've faithfully served in a setting in a place for a long time. You know, I was a part of the same nonprofit for almost 20 years, but we had built some things into our way of living and our way of leading together that had a way of helping things stay fresher. Just for a moment, you know, this online course I mentioned earlier, the name of it is Influence from the Inside Out. Now, what it really is a video resource that's meant to help leaders like me and friends of mine follow this rhythm of Jesus of disengagement, you know, of going away to be with the Father to listen, not sitting down being alone to get a sermon. You have to do that. You have to spend time studying, but just the enjoying of the presence of the Father. And so that's one of the reasons that was the very first thing when my wife and I launched this nonprofit. It was the first thing we produced, because that rhythm for 25 years now has been, it saved my life, it saved our marriage, it saved my ministry, it's enabled me to find my way back to freshness and joy and peace when I had lost my way many times over the last 25. So at this point, I think I'm rambling, but I was just thinking out loud in light of the question you raised.
No, it's beautiful. I think the question, and you're playing with it, just I think points out this. Number one, there's tremendous sincerity and good-heartedness with almost every Christian leader I meet, and at the same time, there's because of the nature, perhaps, of the externals of the ministry, as well as some of the junk in our own lives. There's sometimes a not enoughness that we feel that we're not quite certain what God thinks of it all, because we have very limited ways of measuring or understanding those things. So, any other thoughts along that line?
Yeah, I. You know, I suppose one way to say it is, you know, in my early years as a Christian, most of those in a Baptist sort of environment, you know, the vision of salvation was mostly a door I walked through, and grateful to have found that door and grateful to have found my way through it. But finding along the way the richness of what salvation is, you know, a life and a recovery process from unhealthy and frankly unholy patterns in my own life that have kept me from enjoying the kingdom and prevented me from making it my first search and my central focus, and instead being a person who was trying to find what I desperately felt need for pretty much anywhere but him, and as a pastor doing things like that. But coming to discover that I stepped into something much bigger than I ever thought I did. And my tending my soul, my making sure there's space to follow Jesus in that way, is not a luxury I can't afford. It's a critical necessity I can't afford not to tend well. I really think the communities of faith that, in my case now, mostly leaders, I think they need for me to do a good job of this. I need it at first, but even just in terms of my ministry, when I sell this short and I'm an anxious leader instead of a leader at peace, and I'm a driven leader instead of a relaxed and trusting leader, when I'm very performance oriented instead of being able to be appropriately people focused like Jesus is, well, then ministry from those kinds of broken places just isn't as fruitful, even if I still get the same things done. So, you know, who I am when I do what I do makes a big difference, and tending those things makes a big difference.
Yeah. So let me, I don't know if we have any other questions in the queue at this point. So let me ask this, get into the realm of the extremely practical, or what do I do today? If this kind of conversation stirs up some things and 40, 50 or so people on this call, which I know it has started to stir up some things. What would you do this week to get started at it, as opposed to, making it too big a mountain to climb? What are some really practical in the details of my life, that things that I can do that will begin to move me towards the process of learning how to be relaxed?
Yeah, well, I think one thing I would suggest is if it's not possible to set aside a little chunk of time, an hour or two if you can, to just go sit with God somewhere that you love, a coffee shop or a lake or a forest or a beach or a walk, favorite walk or whatever, for no other reason than to say, God, I'm here. God, you're here. How would you like to be with me? What do you want to bring to mind? What do you want to talk about? Do you just want to be together and that's it? Not walking to get my heart rate to a certain level and burn a certain number of calories. So that's pretty good too. But giving myself and giving really the Father the gift of a little bit of uninterrupted attention. I think a lot of times we forget that the first reason he invited us to come to him was relationship and not servanthood. We are called to be servants. Paul describes himself as such, but I think our servanthood is an expression of our sonship. But too many times my ministry has become this, I work for God, which ends up being translated into a weird sort of Jesus is my boss kind of thing. And, if I were honest, I'm not sure I want to spend much time with my boss. I'll just get more work. And so
I love spending time with my boss. I just wanted to say that.
That's especially if he's on the call.
He is.
No, but there you go. So that would be one that's a little bit bigger picture. Another would be, if you've got a rhythm of meeting with God in the morning, I do. Some people, maybe that's night. I'm not trying to create some legalism out of, morning devotions or something, but give yourself 5 minutes to do nothing more than be with God, to rest, to listen, maybe to read a simple line of the Psalms and let it soak in. Don't come to the scriptures as a sermon prepper, but come to the scriptures just as a child listening to dad. Give yourself 5 minutes. For me, it's literally setting my little timer on the phone so I don't keep looking and say, oh yeah, it's been 36 seconds. Oh yeah, it's been a minute and 15 seconds, but just letting myself have 5 minutes to be still and know that I'm God. That's a really hard command for leaders to respond to, but it's a good one to learn. So just a 5 minute moment where you can be quiet for five, be still for five. Another thing I find that helps me a lot is the practice of gratitude. It slows me down. It reminds me how graced my life already is, that my cup is already full. And so you know, I'm a pessimist by a little bit by nature and a little bit by nurture, I think. And so doing that once a day, somehow just looking back at what I already have and what's already happening and the good that already is and the things God's done that I can say thank you for, that does help me relax inside. When I forget that, you know, especially in a busy season or a hard season, I get more hurried inside. I get more frantic and anxious and fearful and driven inside. So that helps me a lot, just the simple practice of gratitude. I think, too, having friendships that are absolutely non-utilitarian. I don't get any, you know, I don't get any job benefit. You know, I'm not networking. I'm not, you know, picking brains. I mean, I'll learn, you know, but it goes to the need I have to have some non-utilitarian friendships or even activities, because that's part of what helps fill our cup. When everything becomes utilitarian, it's sort of input, output, and my cup still feels mostly empty. So those are a few thoughts about just practicals.
Yeah, that's marvelous. The question that came in the midst of that kind of asked a similar question. But what do you do? Say, okay, I'm going to take these 5 minutes. I'm going to do this. But then you say, you know, I'm really going to take Thursday morning, and I'm going to take 3-4 hours, and I'm just not going to do stuff, and I'm going to be alone with God. I would imagine, particularly if there's a bit of a history with the mind-numbing escapes or just the workaholism or the business, that those experiences can, if we stay in them, it can be something similar to like withdrawal symptoms when you're not engaging with a certain substance that you're used to. What do you do with that? Do you just sit in it? Is there detoxing that has to happen, or what's that process?
Yeah, I think that's a great metaphor. The metaphor of withdrawal. You know, whether it's a withdrawal from what you've been using to be to numb from something unpleasant, or it's withdrawal just from the busy mind. You know, all the things we think about. When you stop, your brain doesn't stop. You know, on a dime, it's more like stopping a freight train, a long, heavy freight train. You know, and if you just slam on the brakes, it's going to be an ugly scene. So just understanding that if you decide you're going to do something like this, it'll take a little while for things to slow down inside. And part of it is realizing there's a classic distinction that's made between involuntary distraction and voluntary distraction. And the first word describes the difference between the two. Involuntary, you can't help the fact that if you stop and become quiet, your mind is not automatically going to stop having thoughts. it'll keep having thoughts. You'll have thoughts about feeling a little cold or itchy or this seems dumb, what a waste of time, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, Nouwen called that, his metaphor for that was monkeys in a banana tree.
Right.
Jumping around, you know. And what I've learned practically is two things you don't do with the monkeys. One, you don't yell at them to stop jumping around. That just stirs them up more. So if you try and fight with those kind of thoughts, you just keep them noisy for the whole time. They'll never get quiet. The thing that you want to do is find a way to just realize, look, my brain is a banana tree full of monkeys. What's the surprise? But if you just kind of let it be and allow yourself to relax and try as best you can to offer the time to be still and know that God's God, remember that God's God. The monkeys finally get tired, and you can get to a place where you're a little quieter. I lead a lot of days like this for leaders, and one of the almost universal comments at the end of a time like this is a comment that they feel like they were given the gift of peace and that they hadn't felt that peaceful in a while. I think we don't realize how much anxiety and drivenness we've taken in, and I think sometimes we don't realize how good peace would actually feel. I'm not saying the only way to get it is to set aside 4 hours to go and be alone. One of the things I would mention is actually my wife and I just here about a month ago put together a a free resource on retreat. It's actually on our Facebook page. If you just went to the Unhurried Living page, you'd see a post somewhere on there about download a free retreat ebook. It's kind of 19 pages. Gives some rationale for that. It gives some guidance for that. It provides, if you wanted to do a partial day or a whole day, or even if you wanted to do an overnighter, kind of a sample schedule. We just felt like it was something that a lot of leaders need. So it's got some real practical guidance about the kind of questions you just raised.
That, Alan, that's great. Lisa's already chasing that down, and we'll send this out, that link
great.
Out to everybody, and make sure that they're able to get a hold of that. I want to close with a prayer for you and your new ministry. As I said, we'll get the information about what's going on, the online course and those things. But is there any last word, anything come to your mind, anything you say, you know, I wish I had mentioned this or that, or anything you sense here before we wind her up?
Yeah, I think maybe what I'd say is sometimes when I'm sharing some of these things with leaders, it just feels daunting. It's like, it sounds like a dream, sounds like a nice oasis that I'll never find my way to. And I think, you know, with leaders, what I want to say is, you know, you really can start exactly where you are. Whatever hurry may or may not look like for you now, in your exact life, in your exact marriage, family, ministry, whatever you do, I would just say find a way to start simple and small, and realize that Jesus would like very much to help you walk with him. Not in that sense of walk with him, like our morality and our conduct and this and that and the other, but quite literally walk through your days with him. And that might be the most unhurrying thing you could do, to invite him to show you how to follow him that way, to invite him to show you what it looks like to be with him in each of the moments of who you are and what you do. That, at least for me, has been a critical element of coming to live a little bit less hurried than I used to.
Cool. Thanks. Can I say a prayer for you before we wind it up here?
Yeah, thanks.
Heavenly Father, Lord Jesus, Holy Spirit, eternal, wonderful, beautiful, good, triune God, we are grateful for this time with Alan here. And we, as a group of women and men on this conversation, we simply lift him and Jem up to you for their new adventure, that you would provide for them in ways that surprise them, that they would experience your goodness in ways that that continue to transform them, that you would use Alan and Jen's gifting and calling to continue to help Christian leaders and all people to know that you are good, and that a life lived in an unhurried way, a relaxed way, is a life that opens us up to your Spirit's transforming power. And so we thank you for this time together in the midst of our often hurried lives, and asking you that you would use this time to bear fruit in our lives as we continue our walk with you.
Oh, I didn't know
anything
different.
Hmm?
I didn't know
anything
different.
Alan and Jeremy here. Okay, some people turn the mute off, but that's okay.
Whoops. It's nice to end with a joyful prayer, right?
It is.
Not just a solemn prayer, but a happy one. That's all right.
Indeed. Okay, Alan, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Kent. Great to be with you and with the rest. Look forward to staying in touch.
Okay, thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.